Well, for our second study, we're going to look at the story of Samson. And I think it would do us good to catch the flavour of this, of the narrative genius of this book of Judges by reading a section of Samson's story. So I'm going to read chapter 16. I hope you won't feel it's a waste of time, just to hear the word of God just as it is on the page. For change. Let's hear God's word then from Judges chapter 16. One day, Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute. He went in to spend the night with her. The people of Gaza were told, "Samson is here." So they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the city gate. They made no move during the night, saying, "At dawn we'll kill him." But Samson lay there only until the middle of the night. Then he got up and took hold of the doors of the city gate, together with the two posts, and tore them loose, bar and all. He lifted them to his shoulders and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Sometime later, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver." So Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me the secret of your great strength and how you can be tied up and subdued." Samson answered her, "If anyone ties me with 7 fresh thongs that have not been dried, I'll become as weak as any other man." Then the rulers of the Philistines brought her 7 fresh thongs that had not been dried, and she tied him with them. With men hidden in the room, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the thongs as easily as a piece of string snaps when it comes close to a flame. So the secret of his strength was not discovered. Then Delilah said to Samson, "You've made a fool of me. You lied to me. Come now, tell me how you can be tied." He said, "If anyone ties me securely with new ropes that have never been used, I'll become as weak as any other man." So Delilah took new ropes and tied him with them. Then with men hiding in the room, she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." But he snapped the ropes off his arms as if they were threads. Delilah then said to Samson, "Until now you've been making a fool of me and lying to me. Tell me how you can be tied." He replied, "If you weave the 7 braids of my head into the fabric on the loom and tighten it with the pin, I'll become as weak as any other man." So while he was sleeping, Delilah took the 7 braids of his head, wove them into the fabric, and tightened it with a pin. Again she called to him, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." He woke from his sleep and pulled up the pin and the loom with the fabric. Then she said to him, "How can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? This is the 3rd time you've made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength." With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was tired to death. So he told her everything. "No razor has ever been used on my head," he said, "because I have been a Nazarite, set apart to God since birth. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me and I would become as weak as any other man." When Delilah saw that he had told her everything, she sent word to the rulers of the Philistines, "Come back once more. He has told me everything." So the rulers of the Philistines returned with the silver in their hands. Having put him to sleep on her lap, she called a man to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him, and his strength left him. Then she called, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." He woke from his sleep and thought, "I'll go out as before and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Then the Philistines seized him, gouged out his eyes, and took him down to Gaza. Binding him with bronze shackles, they set him to grinding in the prison. But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. Now the rulers of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to celebrate, saying, "Our God has delivered Samson, our enemy, into our hands." And when the people saw him, they praised their God, saying, "Our God has delivered our enemy into our hands, the one who laid waste our land and multiplied our slain." And while they were in high spirits, they shouted, "Bring out Samson to entertain us." So they called Samson out of the prison, and he performed for them. When they stood him among the pillars, Samson said to the servant who held his hand, "Put me where I can feel the pillars that support the temple, so that I may lean against them." Now the temple was crowded with men and women. All the rulers of the Philistines were there, and on the roof were about 3,000 men and women watching Samson perform. Then Samson prayed to the Lord, "O sovereign Lord, remember me. O God, please strengthen me just once more, and let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes." Then Samson reached toward the two central pillars on which the temple stood. Bracing himself against them with his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other, Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. Thus he killed many more when he died than while he lived. There's a hunger for heroes these days. We have plenty of celebrities. That's what the modern media produce, of course, celebrities. But celebrities are famous not for their achievements, but for their image, the image they project. Real heroes are hard to find. In fact, these days, real heroes are confined to the celluloid of the movie film, or perhaps to the fantasy cartoon on the television. Bruce Willis in Die Hard, Sylvester Stallone, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and of course, Mr. Universe himself, Arnie, Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's all part, of course, of a myth that goes back centuries. I don't know if you recall, it must be about 10 years ago now, there was a cartoon series on the TV called He-Man, Master of the Universe. I remember it very well because my son insisted for Christmas that he had to have the little plastic model of this He-Man figure. It was absolutely necessary for his survival as a respectable member of his group at school that he had one of these little dolls. So I visited Hamleys when I was in London to try and acquire one and was told pathetically they had run out of stocks within a matter of hours of the toys being delivered. Of course, if Hamleys had read their history books a little more carefully, maybe they wouldn't have been so unprepared for the doll's success, because muscle-bound warriors like He-Man, the strongest man in the universe, have been the focus of popular legend in just about every nation on earth. In fact, He-Man represented a rather enterprising commercial exploitation of those ancient themes, a kind of blonde and youthful Odin fused with a brawny and athletic Hercules. His extraordinary ability to excite the imagination of the young in those days demonstrates just how deeply these heroic images are embedded into our cultural heritage. Many commentators, of course, regard Samson as one more example of the persistence of this kind of epic champion in the world's fairy tales. He too is He-Man, the strongest man in the universe. They point out that he's tearing a part of a lion single-handed, and his uncongenial experience of doing forced labor in the darkness of enemy captivity. Both of these things have analogies to the stories of Hercules in Greek mythology. And some have even suggested that his name, deriving as it probably does from the Hebrew word meaning sun, S-U-N, sun, indicates some kind of connection to the solar myths of other pagan Near Eastern cultures. I think the evidence for that is thin to the point of non-existence. But up to a point, These scholars who want to identify some kind of more general sympathetic vibration between this group of chapters in Judges and ancient mythology may be right. After all, mythology is not quite the same thing as fiction. Romanticized, embroidered, and exaggerated, no doubt, but at the root of all mythology lies not human invention, but human memory. Once upon a time, giants did walk on earth. Godlike in physique, titanic in their exploits. Once upon a time, there was a heroic age, now lost but not forgotten. It survives in the fantasy world of the toy shop today and television cartoons. And Samson perhaps does represent one aspect of the Bible's witness to the authenticity of those dimly remembered human prodigies of the past, like Nimrod the mighty hunter and Goliath the colossus of Gath, and those terrifying sons of Anak and the mysterious Nephilim. Nevertheless, Samson is not a myth. His life is set very firmly in the historical context of the 12th century before Christ, when the Philistines began to settle the coastal plain that we now call the Gaza Strip. Samson is very much, nevertheless, the kind of stuff of which myths are made, even though he isn't a myth. It's not hard, is it, to imagine how fathers would have told the stories of his breathtaking adventures over and over again to wide-eyed sons who refused to go to sleep until he had repeated them another time. Maybe they even made little dolls representing him with which to reenact in play the drama of his mighty deeds. Because unlike Gideon and Abimelech and Jephthah, the other heroes we've studied, Samson was not a leader of men. He was not a general, he was not a politician. Samson was a very individualist hero in the classic mold, a lone wolf, or perhaps it would be more appropriate to say a rogue elephant. He conducts his extraordinary one-man campaign against the Philistine menace. He needs no help from his fellow countrymen. He doesn't need to raise the tribal muster as Gideon and Jephthah did, for Samson is the Terminator. Samson is He-Man, godlike in physique, titanic in his exploits. Samson is the strongest man in the universe. Or is he? That's the paradoxical, half-answered question that hovers around these chapters of Judges, isn't it? For the story of Samson, for all its fairy tale elements, has a very serious side to it. It's not just recited here as a romantic fantasy, but as a very down-to-earth tragedy. Nobody ever had more potential for being mythologized into a Hercules figure than Samson. Yet the book of Judges resolutely doesn't present Samson to us as He-Man, but as a very human. A human who, in spite of his phenomenal and even supernatural endowments, is all too ordinary, all too vulnerable, all too weak. And that, of course, is the unique thing about Bible narrative. It never idealizes its heroes. It never elevates them into mythical demigods. It never succumbs to the Hollywood stereotype. In fact, though the novel as a literary genre is modern, it wasn't invented until a few centuries ago, quite often, I think, our inspired author, the author of this book of Judges, in his candid observation and the psychologically penetrating manner in which he records Samson's biography, comes quite close to a novelist's genius. This is the story of a human being, not mere legend, not mere adventure story, not mere myth. The sacred historian has something to teach us in these chapters, and he communicates it to us as great novelists do. Not by mythological symbols, and not even by direct moralizing, but rather by presenting to us this drama of a human character with whom we empathize, and allowing us, in the openness of the text, as I was mentioning earlier, to draw our own conclusions about this man. Well, let me suggest to you three conclusions that I would draw about him from my study of his story. Three strands that it seems to me are strongly suggested in the story of Samson. The first strand is this, that the best start in life can be wasted. The second strand is this, beware the tyranny of sexual appetite. And the third strand, failure need never be the end of the story. Let's go back to that first strand. The best start in life can be wasted. Turn right back to the beginning of his story, to chapter 13, verses 2 and 3. A certain man of Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. The angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, "You are sterile and childless, but you are going to conceive and have a son." There is a tendency these days, isn't there, to blame all one's mistakes upon one's parents. "I had a bad upbringing," we say. "I get it from my father's side of the family," we say. And some strands of modern psychology have a decidedly deterministic inclination in that respect, don't they? Interpreting all behavior in terms of genetics or environmental conditioning in infancy. Well, Samson could hardly complain on that score. No shadow of the past can really be said to haunt him. He has a privileged beginning, unlike Abimelech and Jephthah, the two earlier stories. True, there is a hint that it was his mother who ruled the roost in his family home. His father, you notice, displays by contrast a rather ineffectual and nervous temperament. When he hears the news of this promised pregnancy, instead of getting out the champagne, Manoah falls on his knees in consternation. Verse 8. Then Manoah prayed to the Lord, "O Lord, I beg you, let the man of God you sent to us come again to teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born." Not, of course, the first man who has come close to fainting at the awful responsibility of fatherhood descending upon his shoulders, but Manoah is a rather extreme example of the paternity anxiety complex, I feel. And when his prayer is answered and he discovers that that prophetic visitor was none other than an angel, he's thrown into an even more violent state of panic. Verse 22, "We are doomed to die," he says to his wife. "We have seen God." No, Manoah's not the kind who keeps his head when all round are losing theirs. But his wife is of a very different stamp. This is the kind of woman you want, you single men out there. Verse 23, "His wife answered, 'If the Lord had meant to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor shown us all these things, nor told us all this.'" See, she's a woman of much greater common sense than Manoah, and a great deal more personal confidence in her reaction. A woman who can take angelic visitations and supernatural pregnancies in her stride like this must surely have been able to cope with bringing up a child, even so strange a child as Samson, without laying the foundation of too much neurosis in his infantile personality. If anything, I think there is a suggestion that Manoah's wife may have spoiled this late and only child, as mothers in that situation perhaps are a little prone to do. We will see evidence of that later. Nevertheless, Samson was a lucky chap, favored in his godly and caring and conscientious parents, favored in his supernaturally ordained conception. He's not plucked out of the crowd like Abimelech or Gideon or Jephthah. From birth, he's set aside for something special. Favored in his intrauterine consecration to God, even. Look at verses 4 and 5. "See to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink." That's always wise in pregnancy, of course. "And that you do not eat anything unclean, because you will conceive and give birth to a son. No razor may be used on his head, because this boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth." Now, the Nazarites, the origin of the Nazarite vow is lost in antiquity. It may well have roots outside of Israelite culture, be one of those things which the Israelites brought in. What we do know is that the law of Moses gave the Nazarite vow a formal definition and a more specifically God-centered orientation. You can read about it in Numbers 6 if you want to follow it up. A Nazarite had to vow three things. First, not to drink alcohol. Second, not to touch dead bodies. And third, not to cut his hair. These three abstentions symbolized a ritual holiness. A ritual holiness was not unlike that of a high priest. The difference was anyone could voluntarily adopt a Nazarite vow, whether they came from a priestly family or not. So this was a way in which a highly motivated person in the Old Testament could express their singular dedication to God. Now often, of course, a Nazarite vow was tied to some special purpose, a need for guidance maybe, a need for healing. Samson's vow was connected to his strength to resist the steady growth of Philistine influence within Israel's borders. His vow, however, had a unique feature. Usually Nazarite vows just lasted a few weeks. His began, as I say, in utero and continued throughout his life. So I suppose in the language of Old Testament ritual, this was a way of saying that this man's consecration to the special task of national deliverance was totally wedded to his personality. Samson was a man who, from the very womb of his mother, had a single and all-consuming vocation in his life. Not for him the torment of having to decide a career. He was quite literally born to be a hero. Verse 24. The woman gave birth to a boy and named him Samson. He grew, and the Lord blessed him, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him. And so, on top of all these other advantages, you see, he received the supreme endowment. The Spirit of God began to move him. The Spirit which, in response perhaps to that silent prayer which his Nazarite vow was, endowed him with such strength that he could rout entire armies single-handed. Chapters 14 and 15 are punctuated by little pictures of just how phenomenally strong he was. In 14 verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him in power so that he tears that lion apart with his bare hands as he might have torn a young goat. This while he's still a child in the home of his parents. 14 verse 19, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him and he strikes down 30 men. Chapter 15, verse 14, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him in power and he strikes down 1,000 men. Incredible. Well, it needs to be remembered that these were days when weapons were simple and all fighting ultimately depended on brute strength and stamina. Our author doesn't tell us that bullets couldn't have killed Samson, merely that he was, in terms of physical prowess, a prodigy. He had a superhuman gift. The thing about gifts, of course, is that they can not only be given, they can also be taken away. 16 verse 20. He woke from his sleep and thought, I'll go out as before and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had left him. I remember once visiting a lady who was obviously deeply worried about her son. He had been getting himself into all kinds of trouble. I think he was, at the time I visited, going to be prosecuted by the police for GBH. And his mother was heartbroken about it. She said something like this, I've done everything for him. He had everything going for him. Told me about the school he'd been to, and how he'd sung in the church choir, and how he would sometimes help the priest at the altar even, and things like this. And she said, well, what did I do wrong? Well, sometimes, of course, children bring disaster upon themselves when their parents have done nothing wrong at all. It's important to hold that fact in tension, isn't it, with what we learned earlier about the shadow from the past. lest we think that all the mistakes and tragedies of our children are down to us. What better start in life could Samson have had than he did have? All the advantages that were his, the blessings, the gifts. He even had the Lord on his side right from the start. Just compare that devout young Nazarite of Dan growing up under the blessing of God's Spirit that we encounter back in chapter 13. Compare that with this broken, humiliated, blinded, shackled ruin of a man that we read about in chapter 16. Can this be the same person? That heroic and that renowned, irresistible Samson, whom unarmed no strength of man or fiercest wild beast could withstand. So John Milton expresses the tragic contrast in his great epic, Samson Agonistes. In that poem, as some of you may know, Milton pictures Manoah, the father, coming to visit his son in his Philistine jail at the end of his life. And he puts into Manoah's mouth the sentiments of 1,000 parents who, like him, suffer the bitterness of disappointed hopes about their precious offspring. I prayed for children, and thought barrenness in wedlock a reproach. I gained a son, and such a son as all men hailed me happy. Who would be now a father in my stead? I've no doubt Manoah and his wife asked themselves what they did wrong too. But the unspoken lesson of the story of Samson, surely, is that this was a man who destroyed himself. Gifts and advantages aren't everything, you see. In spite of all his strength, Samson was a moral weakling, and that moral weakness was quite literally the ruin of him, in spite of all his early advantages. There's a vital lesson for us to learn, isn't there? For many of us, of course, are privileged people. We have advantages. Some of us, perhaps like him, have advantages of birth. We're born into wealthy families, maybe, or born into Christian families, more to the point. Some of us, perhaps like him, have been dedicated to God from our earliest years. Our Christian believing parents have done everything they reasonably could to secure our spiritual growth and our personal happiness. But if we, like Samson, lack moral fiber, then no matter how much we receive by way of advantage of birth, we will bring ruin on ourselves just as surely as he did in the end, and we'll have no one to blame but ourselves. Some of us here, I guess, are talented individuals. Some of us maybe are talented as Samson was in the athletic field. Others of us like to think we're more talented in the intellectual sphere. But either way, we can do things other people can't. It gives us openings in life. Maybe we even muse that our name might one day go down in history for the achievements we have attained. But if we, like Samson, surrender to moral weakness, then our special powers, God-given though they may be, will waste away as surely as his strength did. And we will be helpless victims of a grim and painful situation we can't control, as he became. Some of us here have spiritual gifts. We have known the Holy Spirit endow us in unusual ways for a ministry God has specially entrusted to us, as Samson was entrusted. But if we, like Samson, surrender to moral weakness, then for all our spiritual gifts and endowments, we may yet perish. Saul was numbered among the prophets, wasn't he? And Judas was numbered among the 12. And Jesus it was who said that many would come to him on the last day, speaking of the prophecies that they had made in his name and the miracles they had worked in his name. Then I will say to them, depart from me, I never knew you. Well, Samson was a very privileged man. But learn from his ruin then that gifts aren't everything. The best of starts in life can be wasted. That's the first theme that runs through his story. The second and perhaps the dominant theme in the story of Samson is a warning about the tyranny of sexual appetite. And what a relevant warning that is for our day and generation. Look at chapter 14, first couple of verses. Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. One word, I think, sums up Samson's general attitude to life, something that we see again and again and again in this man: immaturity. There's something about Samson of a child who has never grown up. That's why I say I wonder if his mother spoiled him. There is something infantile about his behavior. Immature, first of all, in its frivolity often. There's a puerile irresponsibility that characterizes an awful lot of what Samson does. Immaturity, secondly, in his vindictiveness. There's a childish but very vicious spitefulness that colors his response whenever he can't get his own way. And thirdly, immaturity in his sensuality. You know, Freudian psychologists sometimes talk about children going through the oral phase. You've no doubt heard of that, when everything goes into the mouth. And some people get stuck, they say, in this oral phase all their life. Well, Samson is a case in point. Psychologically arrested at a stage of habitual self-indulgence. No self-control, no self-denial, just an incessant demand for the immediate gratification of his appetites. It was, as I say, immature. And it's in his relationship with women that this aspect most clearly comes out. Just consider the three accounts we have of his relationships with women. The briefest of those three relationships is actually the one at the beginning of chapter 16 that we covered in our reading, 16 verses 1 to 3. One day Samson went to Gaza, where he saw a prostitute. He went in to spend the night with her. The narrator is surely quite deliberately abrupt in his style there. He saw her, and he went to spend the night with her. Actually, that's a euphemism of our translators. The Hebrew is considerably more blunt in its description of the sexual intercourse which immediately took place. Here then is Samson in typical mood, quite unable to bridle his passions, searching for immediate satisfaction of his lust. It's very difficult to believe this was an isolated incident. The reason this particular incident is recounted is because his frivolity took a hand. While he's with this prostitute, the Philistines in the city plot to ambush him, verse 2. His response, you notice, has a certain John Cleese quality about it. He got up and took hold of the doors of the city gate, together with the two posts, tore them loose, bar and all, lifted them to his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. The narrator then leaves us to imagine the residents of Gaza waking up the following morning, wondering where their city gates have gone, only to discover that by some miracle of levitation, they're sitting on the top of a mountain 38 miles away. It's the rag week stunt to end all rag week stunts, isn't it? But as is sometimes the case with undergraduate humor, Samson's sense of fun doesn't always stay within the bounds of common sense or good taste. Take, for example, the fiasco of his abortive wedding described in chapter 14, this woman of Timnah that he asked his parents to get him. You can hear, can't you, once again, the greedy self-indulgence behind that peremptory demand. I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah, now get her for me as my wife. Parental advice counts little when Samson's hormones are buzzing. His father and mother replied, isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife? See, a marriage between a Philistine girl and an Israelite was bound to cause suspicion and disapproval on all sides, especially when the man in question had a reputation like that of Samson. We're told in verse 11 of chapter 14 that when Samson lays on the traditional marriage feast, his Philistine in-laws give him 30 companions. Some commentators, I think, rightly suggest But since these companions were assigned to Samson, it seems, rather than him inviting his own male friends to the party, they probably represented on the part of the Philistines a kind of informal bodyguard to make sure Samson didn't cause any trouble. Well, whether that's so or not, it's certain that a man of any tact or any discretion in such a situation of potential domestic tension would have tried his best to keep relationships cordial at the wedding. But what do we find instead? Samson, true to his infantile temperament, gets his 30 companions involved in a ridiculous bet, centering around a totally absurd riddle which he has made up on his way to the banquet. Verse 12. "Let me tell you a riddle," Samson said to them. "If you can give me the answer within 7 days of the feast, I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. But if you can't tell me the answer, you must give me 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes." "Tell us your riddle," they said. "Let's hear it." He replied, "Out of the eater something to eat, out of the strong something sweet." This reminds me of the sort of unanswerable and inane joke that my children bring home from school. You know, the sorts of jokes which are not designed to test the wits at all, but to make the other person look thoroughly foolish. And I'll tell you one that I heard not so long ago. "How do you keep an idiot waiting?" "I'll tell you later." Well, in Samson's case, however, the situation was made all the more serious, you see, because of the stakes which he had fastened on this ridiculous bet. 30 linen garments and 30 sets of clothes. Now, this almost certainly represents the traditional gift which Samson, as host, properly speaking, owes to these 30 male companions at his feast. You know how we give a present to the bridesmaids? Well, he would have been expected to give such a gift to his best men, these 30 best men who are his companions. In other words, Samson is here gambling with his wedding guests to cover the cost of the reception. That's what it comes down to. It's really in very bad taste. And it's no wonder that the 30 young men have no intention of letting him get away with it. Verse 15. On the fourth day, they said to Samson's wife, "Coax your husband into explaining the riddle for us, or we will burn you and your father's household to death. Did you invite us here to rob us?" They lean then on Samson's new bride to wheedle the answer out of him, which she does. She was a Philistine, after all, and owed loyalty to her own kin. When Samson discovers, however, that his little riddle has been betrayed, instead of accepting the situation with good grace and a friendly chuckle to diffuse the hostile atmosphere, as certainly Jephthah, I feel, would have done, his immaturity is almost unbelievable. Verse 18. "Before sunset on the seventh day, the men of the town said to him, 'What is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?' Samson said to him, 'If you had not ploughed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle.' And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, and he went down to Ashkelon, struck down 30 of their men, stripped them of their belongings, and gave their clothes to those who had explained the riddle. Burning with anger, he went up to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended him at the wedding." See the petulance and the puerile spite of his reaction. "Ploughed with my heifer" has, frankly, a very vulgar connotation, very vulgar innuendo to it. In fact, the whole couplet, "If you had not ploughed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle," rings with the kind of lilting rhyme you associate with playground chants of little children. Doesn't take much to imagine, does it? The pouted lips and the stamping foot and the sulky eyes with which he says it. And as for this vicious and unprovoked attack on Ashkelon, well, I'm afraid the only word for that is a fit of temper. We've all seen frustrated children storming to their room and slamming the door and so forth. But we don't expect that kind of behavior from adults, still less spirit-filled he-men. But that is Samson all over, you see. And I'm afraid it doesn't stop there. There is a sequel to this story in chapter 15. We're told in the last verse, you see, of chapter 14, that because Samson's in such a mood, he storms off and deserts his bride and never completes the wedding ceremony. As a result, the young lady in question, to avoid the humiliation of being jilted at the altar, is married instead to Samson's best man. Things like that happened in those days, be warned. And frankly, after his disgraceful behavior at the wedding, I don't think Samson could really complain about that. But of course he did. Verses 1 and 2. Later on, at the time of the wheat harvest, Samson took a young goat and went to visit his wife. He said, "I'm going to my wife's room," but her father would not let him go in. "I was so sure you thoroughly hated her," he said, "that I gave her to your friend. Isn't her younger sister more attractive? Take her instead." Now again, within the sort of terms of reference of this ancient culture, a mature person would have accepted this situation. Jacob certainly did, when he was rather similarly done out of a wife, you may recall. But not Samson. His spiteful sense of humor triumphs again over his good judgment, verse 3. Samson said to them, "This time I have a right to get even with the Philistines. I'll really harm them now." So he went out and caught 300 foxes, ties them tail to tail in pairs. He then fastens a torch to each pair of tails, lit the torches, and let the foxes loose in the standing grain of the Philistine. Well, frankly, this is a sort of cruel and destructive prank you associate with juvenile delinquents. He must have known the fury this would stir up, such an act of wanton vandalism. Now, this kind of violence was meat and drink for Samson. He was an irresponsible mischief maker. Verse 6. When the Philistines asked, "Who did this?" they were told, "Samson, the Timnite son-in-law, because his wife was given to his friend." So the Philistines went up and burned her and her father to death. Samson said to them, "Since you've acted like this, I won't stop until I get my revenge on you." He attacked them viciously and slaughtered many of them. By the time the day is over, in verse 15, he has in fact felled his 1,000 men using the jawbone of an ass as his only weapon, celebrated his gruesome bloodbath with another piece of his coarse and infantile doggerel in verse 16. This is our hero, then. A man with so much in his favor, yet so lacking in self-discipline, so lacking in wisdom, as often to behave like a bull on heat. And the end is almost inevitable. A man like this is hardly going to settle down with some nice, easygoing girl, is he? 16 verse 4. Sometime later, he fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. It does seem at last that Samson may have discovered the difference between love and lust from the way the narrator describes this relationship. For the first time since his broken betrothal, some kind of committed relationship is what Samson wants. He's fallen in love. Yet his sensuality is still in control, not his good judgment. So infatuated is he by the physical attractions of this woman, it renders him completely blind to the treacherous streak in her behavior. Not once, not twice, but three times, you notice, as we read that story in chapter 16, she tries to betray him to the Philistines. Was Samson so stupid that he didn't realize that it must be she who had set up the ambush? Was he really fooled by that feigned cry of alarm, "Samson, the Philistines are on you"? A Judas kiss, if ever there was one. Surely he must have realized. And maybe not. Delilah has all the marks of a very shrewd and clever woman. Far cleverer than Samson. It's quite clear she could twist him round her little finger. Remember, we are talking about a treachery that was plotted over the course of years, not just of days or weeks. And the demands of passion in a man like Samson blur the common sense. One remembers, too, Solomon's comment about the corrosive effects of a woman's whining tongue. "A quarreling wife is like a constant dripping on a rainy day," says Solomon. Well, so eventually it became, didn't it, with Samson and Delilah. with such nagging, verse 16, she prodded him day after day until he was tired to death. So he told her everything. It wasn't, of course, that his strength was tied up with his hair in some kind of magical way. Nor was it, as some have suggested, that Samson merely believed his strength was in his hair and so was rendered psychologically impotent by its removal. No, the text is quite clear. Samson's strength was derived directly from God. It was a supernatural charisma he had sustained in him from his earliest years. Samson had never known what it was like to be without this charisma. Perhaps he didn't really believe he ever could lose it. It was so much part of him. Perhaps he'd even begun to believe that his unique powers belonged to him in some inalienable way, that the Nazarite vow was a nuisance anyway. He'd broken it often enough in touching dead bodies, after all. He certainly wasn't prepared for the disaster that God brought upon him for breaking the vow. Then she called Samson, "The Philistines are upon you." He woke from his sleep and thought, "I'll go out as before and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Perhaps it was a poetic irony that they put out his eyes. After all, it was his eyes that had got him into trouble so often, wasn't it? He saw a woman, "Get her for me." He saw a prostitute and spent the night with her. He fell in love with a woman in the Valley of Sorek. If only he could have controlled his eyes, he might have been okay. His frivolity could, after all, be amusing at times, and his vindictiveness in that violent era maybe could even be forgiven. But his intemperate sensuality, that really had no excuse, nor did it have any painless remedy. In the end, he paid for it in the most humiliating way imaginable. And let us say again, is a theme that surely the author is wanting us to pick up as we read the book of Judges, though the author never moralizes about Samson, never draws moralizing lessons explicitly out of Samson's life in this respect, he surely intends us to discern that those who are tyrannized by their sexual appetites will come to ruin. We live, of course, in a day when sexual expectations of men and women are being elevated to quite ridiculous heights. We're being brainwashed by novels and films and TV soap operas into basing our estimate of our own self-worth often on the competence of our sexual performance or the variety of our sexual experience. And our eyes, like Samson's, are being subtly trained by 1,000 adverts every day to assess the desirability of the opposite sex in purely physical terms. John White, you know, the author who wrote the book Eros Defiled, says that when he sent that manuscript to a Christian publisher in the USA, it was sent back to him with a comment more or less like this: "This isn't the kind of book Christians need. What they want these days is a manual on how Christian couples can enjoy sex." Premarital sex in the University of Cambridge, where I spend a lot of my time, isn't naughty anymore. It's just normal. In the old days, the persistent problem you encountered helping people with was sexual guilt. These days, you have a problem getting people to feel guilty at all about their sexual behavior. I'll learn from Samson that sex isn't everything. Those who are tyrannized by their sexual appetites will surely come to ruin. But time is slipping away, so let me go to the third theme, which I think is an important one in Samson too. And the redeeming lesson of his sad, sad story. Namely, that failure doesn't have to be the end of everything. Look at verse 22 of chapter 16. Such a poignant, such a clever author, this. "But the hair on his head began to grow again." He lets you work out what that might mean. You see how he dangles you, teases you? "The hair on his head began to grow again." Maybe there is somebody here who's feeling completely discouraged by what we've been saying this morning. Maybe there's somebody like Samson who feels they've had great opportunities in life, but you've wasted them. Maybe there's somebody here who feels like they're on the scrap heap in the darkness of that Philistine jail with no one to blame but themselves. Maybe there's someone like Samson who's allowed sexual passion to dominate their lives, and you're beginning to experience the self-destructive consequences of that lack of self-discipline. Maybe there's somebody who feels like Samson in his Philistine prison, that the Lord has left him, and now you feel spiritually deserted. Well, the final theme of this story is for you, I suggest, one of great hope. Hope for two reasons. First, because our failures are not God's failures. I mean, just look back right to the beginning of this story, 14 verse 4. His parents did not know that this was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines, for at that time they were ruling over Israel. As I say, it's very unusual for our author to inject that kind of interpretive comment. Most of the time, he leaves the text open for you to interpret it. But he feels this is such an important insight, he's worried we're going to miss it if he doesn't spell it out. So he injects it there so that we may know, even if his parents didn't, that this whole business of Samson and this Philistine girl was from the Lord, who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines. Now, some people take that verse to mean that Samson was consciously, deliberately seeking a Philistine bride in order to have an opportunity to weaken the Philistine military hold on Israel. I have to say, I think that's most optimistic. Samson never does anything except out of basically self-centered, hedonistic motives. The whole of his story illustrates that. He chose this Philistine girl for no other reason than that he desired her physically. What the inspired author is pointing out to us there is that in spite of the lack of nobility in Samson's motives, God had a purpose in it. In spite of Samson's frivolous and spiteful and sensual nature, God was working out his will, even through such a man. Sometimes you hear people say, we must be holy vessels before God can use us. If we're not holy, God can't use us. Well, I don't believe that's right. The reason we are to be holy is not so God can use us, but so that we can be fit for his use. But God is never limited by our unholiness. If God had to wait around to find clean vessels, he'd never be able to do anything in this fallen world, would he? No. He regularly uses sinners. He regularly uses unbelievers. The classic example for the Christian, of course, in that respect, is the cross, where human wickedness did its worst, but God was achieving his eternal counsel. Well, he may be disappointed by our sins, bitterly disappointed, but he is never surprised, and he is never thwarted. Indeed, he anticipates and he exploits even our failures, as he did Samson's. And I think that should be an encouragement to us, you know. Maybe some of us here have made big mistakes. Mistakes that, when we recall them to mind, make us groan inwardly. That does not mean our life is now a write-off, as far as God is concerned. It does not mean we are condemned to permanent second best, as I hear some people say. He has still been working his sovereign purpose out, even in the midst of all our weaknesses and our failures. Our failures are not his failures. But the end of Samson's story is a message of hope for a second reason too. Not only are our failures not God's failures, but our failures need never be the last word. Look again at verse 28. Then Samson prayed to the Lord. Have we ever heard Samson pray to the Lord before? I think you will find this is a wholly new experience for our hero. Oh, I know the vindictiveness is still there. It would have been nice if Samson's motivation in this last Herculean exploit had been a little less motivated by personal revenge. Let me get revenge for my two eyes. A little more concerned for the honor of God's name over against the idols of Philistia, perhaps. His exploit would have been nobler if his motives had been nobler, but at least Samson is at last being serious. At least Samson is at last being spiritual. At least Samson is at last praying. Sometimes, you see, it takes a great deal to bring us to that point of real prayer. Sometimes we have to fail very badly. But such failure never needs to be the last word. In fact, in a kind of paradoxical way, it's only when, like Samson, we are humbled by failure, to feel perhaps for the first time our natural inability, that God really has the opportunity to work savingly in our hearts. There was a man in the New Testament, you remember, who had to be blinded before he could hear God's voice and ask God's forgiveness. And it was he who wrote that line, God's grace is made perfect in weakness. If I must boast, he said, I will boast about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. For his sake I delight in weakness, for when I am weak, I'm strong. Of course you fail. We all have failed. We all have memories of failure that we are embarrassed about. Thank God the church is not an academy for perfect saints. It is a hospital for sinful failures. Failure is never the end of everything. Sometimes, with the help of Jesus Christ, it can be the beginning of